Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual of two guests today. In moments, Anne Elizabeth Moore will talk about her new book, Body Horror. And after her, the economist Greg Kaplan will talk about trends in lifetime earnings of U.S. workers over the last five decades. Before that, a few words of my own. I also posted this to my blog, lbo-news.com, on Wednesday evening. How much longer can this go on? As I write this, Predicted gives 71-29 odds that Trump will last the year, but it's mighty tempting to buy the no, especially after the revelation that he asked Comey to shut down the Flynn investigation. Disclosure alert, I bought 100 shares of no at 28 cents a share. What is the endgame of the people, mostly Democrats, pounding the drums most heavily? Do they want to impeach Trump, which seems a long shot given Republican control of Congress? Do they want to bruise his weak ego so badly that he resigns? Clearly, the job is much harder than he ever imagined. And by the way, what reasonably sentient person over the age of 8 ever thought the presidency wasn't grindingly hard? But he also wants adulation, not the relentless volleys of grief he's gotten. It's not impossible to imagine him just walking off stage, especially if his legal situation gets seriously dicey. What then? President Pence? If Pence were president, the entire Republican dream agenda would sail through Congress in like 3 weeks. Pence spent a dozen years in the House, Tea Party branch, and 4 years as governor of Indiana. He's an appalling figure, but he knows how things work. He might not be able to overcome his party's internal divisions, but he probably could do a better job than Trump, and every day would not be a circus as it is now. Pence is a horror. Fiscal sadist, misogynist, homophobe, lover of the carceral state. He's repeatedly described himself as a, quote, Christian, conservative, and a Republican in that order, though given today's modern GOP, it's not clear that there's much of a difference among those features. He should have said that he's a reactionary Christian. There are plenty of other kinds. Pence is a creationist who rejects climate change, thinks stem cell research is obsolete, and once actually said that smoking doesn't kill. His anti-abortion law was the most extreme in the country. His cuts to Planned Parenthood led to a rural HIV epidemic. Like Sessions, Pence is a maximalist on drugs, including weed. He's hot to privatize Social Security. He likened the Supreme Court's upholding of Obamacare to 9/11. Should Trump get pushed out, the orchestrated campaign of healing would be painful. It's not far-fetched to imagine leading Democrats channeling Gerald Ford's "Our long national nightmare is over." And by the way, after I wrote this, historian Douglas Brinkley was quoted in Politico saying pretty much that. There would be something of what Wall Street calls a relief rally on the transition, and it would perversely grease the way for Pence to make the U.S. more like the Indiana he left behind. We should be fighting to keep Trump in office as fatally damaged goods. Several things seem to be driving this campaign to squeeze Trump out, aside from the obvious fact that he's an unstable ignoramus. Dems still can't get over the fact that they lost to the most unpopular candidate in the history of polling, but instead of blaming their own terrible candidate, the second most unpopular candidate in the history of polling, and the slaver's legacy, the Electoral College, they want to blame Russia. Time was they blamed Comey, too. Remember when Paul Krugman said that, quote, Comey and Putin installed a crazy, vindictive, can't-handle-the-truth person in the White House, close quote. But Comey has since been rehabilitated. But that's not all. A large part of the political class, Hillary prominent among them, along with John McCain, the security establishment, and their contract-hungry patrons, the military-industrial complex, all want desperately to make Russia the enemy and are reviving zombie tropes from the Cold War to promote their cause. Trump may well have friends in the Russian mob, but his resistance to elite hostility towards the country is one of the few non-awful things about him. It's been stunning to watch liberals cheering on the security state's war by leak against Trump. He's odious, but he is the legally elected president under an absurd electoral system, but that's the one we've got. It all makes you wonder what they would have done to Sanders if by some imaginable fluke he'd won. And yet we've seen months of praise for the CIA and the FBI as the magic bullets who could deliver us from the short-fingered vulgarian. The defenses of the CIA began with Trump's disparaging remarks about the agency before taking office, which were taken as near blasphemous. For an amateur like Trump, such attacks were extremely risky. In early January, Chuck Schumer presciently warned, Let me tell you, you take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday of getting back at you. You'd almost think that Schumer knew what would come next. An endless series of leaks portraying Trump as Putin's towel boy, and as an extra special bonus, a pervert, the P-tape, all applauded by liberals with little regard for the CIA's 70-year history of lying, assassination, and coups. Then came the Comey firing, and suddenly the FBI was a noble organization as well. It's far from that, and has always been. As Mark Ames reports in his little history of the Bureau, it has no legal charter. Congress didn't want to authorize a secret police, so Teddy Roosevelt created it by executive fiat. Much of the Bureau's history has been about persecuting communists and gay people, and smearing its enemies. It spent the 1960s and early 70s trying to ruin Martin Luther King, the Black Panthers, and the New Left. In other words, it's been political from the very first, and all these current worries about politicizing the Bureau are grade A BS. Which brings us back to the endgame issue. Democrats look to be extending the strategy of their failed 2016 campaign by being the not Trump and nothing more. It's all they've got. They are making no visible effort to come up with an appealing agenda as an alternative to the deeply unpopular one the GOP has on offer. In fact, they're annoyed at Bernie Sanders for trying to get the party to talk about policy, which is somehow seen as an act of narcissism in the Beltway worldview. This passage actually appeared in Politico the other day. But the senator, referring to Sanders, who will be 79 the next time the New Hampshire primary rolls around, is continuing to put himself at the center of the conversation. He's introduced a Medicare for All bill this week that he hopes will force others to sign on. Imagine that, pushing a bill to expand health insurance coverage at a moment when Republicans are trying to take it away. The ego of that man. The party's strategy can't be counted a success on conventional measures. Gallup reports that the Dems have lost 5 approval points since November, leaving the two parties with near identical approval ratings, Democrats 40, Republicans 39. During the early days of the Trump administration, it seemed like a serious left opposition might take form. That's a hazy memory now that so many liberals and even leftists are taking dictation from the security state and throwing around words like treason. We can do better than this, can't we? And now on to Anne Elizabeth Moore. She's been on this show a couple of times before, discussing her explorations of the garment industry in Cambodia. She's here now to talk about her new collection, Body Horror, Capitalism, Fear, Misogyny Jokes, just out from the small Chicago-based publishing house Curbside Splendor. Here she is to talk about homeownership, chronic illness, getting revenge on rapists, and the working conditions of models. Anne Elizabeth Moore. Cheerful topics you've got here. Misogyny, chronic illness, capitalism, although you do promise in the subtitle jokes and you do supply those. Is there some kind of overarching structure here to this collection of essays or theme that you were thinking in, as you put it together?
Not really, actually. I'm getting a little bored of structures. And I felt like with this collection, I wanted to both make it as organic, sort of in a literary sense as possible, but also I've just been gardening more and composting more. And I felt like I wanted the book to be a reflection of the way that you put stuff together and let it sit and kind of rot and do something good in the world. And I think that there are a couple essays that move from medical journalism to personal essay to literary criticism. I don't know that that was entirely deliberate to just try to mix those up, but that was the way I wanted the book to come together, was just this, like, let's just make the idea that comes out of them more useful than the way that it's actually structured.
Whole greater than some of the parts.
Hopefully.
I like the idea of productive rot, though. That's a
a
nice concept. Yeah, so after many years in Chicago, you're now living in a house in Detroit.
Yeah. It's so crazy.
This has changed your life?
It has changed my life in every way. I mean, for one, I left all my friends, so that's a big change. But so I was given a house in Detroit by the Wright House Foundation, organization, I guess. And home ownership has, like, fundamentally changed the way that I operate as a creative person, as a writer, as a, like, freelancer, as someone who...
You own the house?
The house is not yet in my name. It will be in 1 year.
So has this changed your consciousness, the accumulation of property?
Yeah.
You being unbourgeoisified?
I kind of am. I would like to find a way to work through that, obviously, but it's completely true that I was given this property, and it just changes the way that you react to the world.
And in what ways?
I no longer have to sort of re-navigate my space every time I leave my apartment for, a month. There's, in many ways, more stability, but there's also, like, sense of wealth accumulation that happens when you own property that's completely new to me, that like I kind of didn't even believe existed.
The money piles up just as you're sitting there.
It's the imagined scenario is that it does. Yes, it's not actually in any way really doing that, but that I'm now someone who sort of sits in the world in a way where that's possible is changing the way that the projects that I take on and the kinds of things that I think about writing about.
Well, when Margaret Thatcher privatized the council housing in Britain, she did it in part for just economic reasons, conventional von Mises, Hayek economic reasons. But she also, as she said, economics is a tool, but we want to change people's souls. And she wanted to instill a notion of ownership among people who were transient and dependent upon the public sector. I mean, do you feel your soul changing now?
In some ways, I think that's true, but I also think that weird false dichotomy between there's only instability versus stability is obviously sort of false and effed up in the first place, right? I would have liked to have a sense of security with the lifestyle that I was living before, but there aren't funds enough to support me in doing that, to support me in like freelancing and running around the world whenever I wanted to, and then having a stable place to live when I came back. So that changed is not so much a reflection, I think, of how great privatized housing is as it is a reflection of how everything is sort of shuffled toward that, and there's not a lot of other positive reinforcement for other ways of being in the world.
It is the social setup. You're not pulling down big coin for writing critiques of Cambodian garment factories?
Isn't that weird? People don't shell out the big bucks for telling you how horrible capitalism is. I mean, you apparently tap that.
Yes, I'm very familiar with these rewards. The major topics of the book, well, a lot of it is chronic illness. So what happened to you in recent years?
Yeah, well, when I was actually in Cambodia covering the largest garment workers uprising in the history of the country that then was sort of quelled by surprise violence from the prime minister who sent the military police out to shoot protesters.
Parenthetically, I didn't realize how violently repressive Cambodia is, but it's quite a scene.
Yeah, the history of it was violent. There was a period of time where it was not necessarily as evidently violent. And then in this one day, January 4th, 2014, it sort of all came back. They had sense memories of what it was like under the Khmer Rouge or under the democratic elections that followed them where people were shot for not voting properly. And so the country just shut down thereafter. But in that moment of sort of violent, sudden repression, I had two things happen in my body, and one of them was that my physical body was no longer working the way that it was supposed to. So I felt bad, I felt pain, and I wasn't recovering from it. And the other thing that was weird was that I also lost the ability to feel fear, like my adrenal glands had actually stopped working. It was a medical condition, right? I was surrounded by actual danger, like actually maybe, probably no one was going to shoot me, but there were, you know, potential negative things going to happen. And there definitely was something bad happening in my body, but I had lost the ability to actually see it as dangerous. And that, again, was a physical manifestation of autoimmune diseases, which I had accrued by then several of magically. And that was kind of the moment where I was like, oh my God, something has got to shift up here because this is literally crazy.
And so what were the symptoms then? You stopped being able to heal?
Well, so with autoimmune disease, all of your immune functions just kick into high gear. And so in that moment, I realized that I hadn't actually been sick in at least a year. At the time, if I would get a cut, I would heal enormously quickly, like overnight, my skin would heal up. There's a lot of like chronic pain and inflammation stuff, various food sensitivities and all sorts of like bodily reactions. But I think what most people experience when they have an autoimmune disorder sort of suddenly appear is just general like badness, like tiredness and inability to process, and you can't figure out what's going on. Part of that being a reflection of the fact that nobody knows why they happen or what they come from.
I was going to say, this is not something the medical profession understands well.
Right. And of course, the majority of autoimmune disorders are experienced in the bodies of women, and there's no sort of economic incentive to actually research or respond to them properly. So all the treatments are like luck, people lucked into figuring out that they were helpful in some way, and they're all horrible and barbaric and stupid.
And heavy cancer drugs too.
Yeah, so I take chemo once a week, which is like you shouldn't be on chemo every week. It's not, doesn't make any sense. It's not a good idea, but it's one of the only effective treatments for doing this stuff.
And you have a chapter or how you nearly died.
Yeah. Well, so one of the pieces I had to take out of the book was about one of the prescription drugs that I was given when chemo failed and nearly took out my liver. And then I was put on this like drug that would have stepped up things by a couple notches, but it's the most popular drug in the world, Humira. The new drug...
They advertise on TV, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Yep. There are millions and millions and millions of people, literally the most popular drug in the world. And it's constantly being used to treat new autoimmune disorders. And I was given this drug and something went wrong. I couldn't tell what it was. I felt bad again. I was all of a sudden allergic to the sun, and then my hair started falling out, and it wasn't really helping anything. And it turns out that it had given me lupus, which is a very small, unknown side effect of Humira that isn't popularly addressed enough, even that my doctor had warned me about it. So all of a sudden I had, like, at the time it was like 6 autoimmune diseases. Lupus is the craziest because it can operate on almost any organ in your body and it sort of shifts. And it operates on women of color much more harshly than it operates on white women. I am a white woman, so that was not a particular danger to me. But one of the things that ends up being terrifying about the popularity of Humira, especially as it spreads around the world, is that it's killing women of color faster than it's killing anyone else. The effects of a drug that accidentally gives a lot of people lupus is incredibly bad for particular bodies in the world. Anyway, my deal was that all of a sudden I had lupus, didn't know what that was about. I had then 7 different diseases that were sort of conflicting, a bad liver in the first place, no real way to respond to any of these diseases. And basically my doctors were like, well, let's just see if you survive the summer. I was like, that's not fun.
It's a cheerful comment.
Yeah, yeah.
And you did, obviously.
I did. That is true. Spoiler alert, still alive.
You say, I think at one point 75% and then another point 85% of the people with autoimmune diseases are women. Why is that? Is there some kind of somatized social critique in there or something?
Well, I have one, of course, but it fits into a lot of these debates about women being closer to nature, right? Or women being somehow more sensitive to things because of the ability to bear children. I don't know about any of that stuff. I kind of don't care about any of it. But for whatever reason, these drugs that do tend to have environmental roots do seem to affect women more quickly and more blatantly. And autoimmune diseases are diseases that seem to come from globalized food production, or be at least affected by a combination of globalized food production and hyper...
You might think that would affect men in equal numbers, though.
Except that they don't happen to.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why, and I would like someone to look into why.
Yeah. No, I kept thinking as I was reading it that, you know, the early days of psychoanalysis, when they focused on hysteria among bourgeois women,
yeah,
that there's a reading of that, that there was a kind of stifled feminist protest involved in the hysteria, that protesting the oppression of women and you know, generalized misogyny.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, is this something, you know, 100-some years later, analogous, that there is like some kind of, if not protest, some, you know, bodily symptom of pervasive misogyny?
I mean,
have you thought about that? Or
is how I
read it. We're falling
in
the trap, of course. You know, the illness is metaphor trap.
Exactly. And I do think that that is useful in many ways. Illness is metaphor. Then again, we have to sort of think about whether or not using illness as a device when it is still sort of killing people is, you know, like how to navigate the sort of realities of that. But it's also the effects of autoimmune disorders affecting women in greater numbers than men, whether or not it's caused by misogyny inherent in capitalism, which I happen to think that it is, it's continued evidence of it. And so I feel like from a like slightly more materialist standpoint, we can still make similar arguments.
Do you experience doctors who say you're just some crazy chick and it's all in your head?
Yeah. When I clearly had lupus and was in my doctor's office reading the effects of lupus from my cell phone to him, he told me that that wasn't possible. I mean, I'm sitting there with documents explaining that it's possible. And
is that the doctor who called his boss and, or is that a different doctor?
Yeah. No, doctors turn out to be unbelievably stupid. Like I've met maybe 600 in the last 3 years, and there's about three that I ended up like having any respect for. Not to be a total horrible person about it, but like they don't know what they're doing.
And they're not very nice about it.
And I grew up, you know, my parents were doctors, so I kind of knew that was coming, but like, geez.
Both parents were doctors.
Now, yes. My father, when I was growing up, and my mom went into it after.
Wow. That's an interesting thing in itself.
Especially in this context. My dad was a doctor. He was a neuroradiologist that had MS. He had multiple sclerosis, an autoimmune disorder, and he used his knowledge of it to hide it from the family so he wouldn't lose his job. Because a doctor with a neurological disease that treats neurological diseases isn't cool.
Yeah, physician, heal thyself.
Yeah, exactly. If he had sort of been open about it, like imagine what he could have researched or thought about or done. But no, he just hit it. Now we're all screwed.
I'm speaking with Anne Elizabeth Moore, author of Body Horror, published by Curbside Splendor.
The essay about, I can't remember the name of the movie. It's I Spit in Your Grave?
Yeah.
Tell us about that. That was a fascinating thing, and it makes me want to see it now.
Oh, haven't you seen it?
No, I've never seen it. Well, I'm cinematically illiterate, so I've seen very few things.
I Spit on Your Grave is basically the story of a young woman writer who goes off to the woods to, like, you know, pursue her whatever novel, and to get sort of hunted by the neighbor boys, who are all lower class people. So class analysis is horrible. But she's sort of hunted.
The movie was widely panned, too, right?
Zero stars. Roger Ebert called it some flaming pile of garbage of some, you know, more slightly more eloquent variety. And no one really remembers it. It maybe has this teeny cult following. But even the cult following is like, oh, you should see this, like, awful movie. But she is gang raped, and then she sort of enacts revenge in a deliberate and sort of plotting and thoughtful manner. The film is basically criticized for being like unthinkably stupid because it basically just doesn't follow in like the masculine gaze, right? It doesn't follow this like masculine logic of like she got raped and that's horrible, so she should just give up and stop participating in the world. And it is reflected in Virginie Despentes' King Kong theory, where she also talks about the French filmmaker, horror filmmaker, theorist, also talks about, like, you know, the idea of rape in culture might actually change if women just started carrying knives around. Like, if it were genuinely a concern for men that they would get their dicks cut off every time they committed sexual assault of some kind, like, the dynamics might change. And I Spit on Your Grave is sort of...
In some sense, that seems kind of hard to argue with.
And yet we'd need to see depictions of it to know whether or not that felt true or to test whether or not it was true. And we don't see depictions of it because it doesn't fit into how we understand culture. So
but,
I Spit on
Your Grave.
The movie
is sympathetic with this point of view, though.
I would say, yeah. The theory was written after I Spit on Your Grave came out, which was, I think, 1971 or 74 or something. But they're sort of a piece, yeah.
But then you reflect on women's complicity in misogyny and patriarchy.
Yeah.
Like, could you talk about that?
Yeah. I Spit on Your Grave deals with this by having no other women in the film at all, which should be noted when we're talking about this stuff. And I was even just talking to a friend who writes for the New York Times dance section. And she was talking about, like, just being bored of rape in ballet. She's just bored of seeing rapes in ballet, which shouldn't be an arguable statement, but it did kick off this, like, massive argument about, like, you shouldn't censor ballet, right? We should all be allowed to explore sexual
ballet
violence.
Ballet has changed since my first wife used to take me to it.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it hasn't changed very much. We just don't talk about the rape scenes very much. This conversation was largely women jumping in and being like, no, rape is fine. Like, don't worry about it. What are you so concerned about? And that Virginie Despentes also sort of talks about, you know, she was with a female friend when she was raped and she didn't pull her knife out and she didn't defend herself or her friend, and the, you know, guilt, but also like complicity, therefore, in the what we call rape culture, in this like larger misogynistic culture, lets us understand that misogyny is something that is performed by women, which also shouldn't be arguable. Of course it's going to be performed by women, but it's not something we admit, and it's not something we think about in the terrain of, like,
that's,
how do we
that's
actually...
the way systems are. You can't get out of them very easily.
Yeah, exactly. So what, we're not supposed to talk about them? Or...
Yeah, there was this vogue for women's self-defense back in second wave feminism days.
Yeah.
That I don't hear much about it anymore, but it seems like
and it's
it might be
like,
a good idea.
Yeah, this thing where it's sort of rediscovered and people are like, oh, why don't you just become physically empowered? And then the empowerment debates happen, which don't really do anything for anyone. But it's always like discovered anew. Mm-hmm. And then there's nothing that builds up or lasts about
that. I guess there's a point of view that you're putting too much of a burden on women to respond to it. But on the other hand, you know, the men are not going to change spontaneously.
Well, there's also this very real situation now that if women are getting sicker significantly faster than men, like, self-defense isn't really the response, right? We have to actually come up with something that's about health and vitality at a much higher level than telling the bodies that are in the most danger that they need to, like, fix whatever is wrong with them.
This is a bit of a swerve in conclusion, but there's a piece about models, the working condition of models, which is, you know, not something that generally excites the sympathy of people who are interested
anyone.
In labor or anybody.
Yeah.
Yes, you know, they're beautiful and they're famous and they've got it all.
Yeah.
But unless you're the kind to make $10,000 an hour, actually, you don't, right? It's a pretty tough job, and it doesn't pay very well.
And actually, even the ones who make $10,000 an hour maybe don't get another job that year. Modeling is tough. And, you know, that essay is a little bit of, like, the essay version of my comics journalism book, Threadbare, that tracked connections between the garment industry sort of all along the supply chain to human trafficking. And I was asked to come speak to a group of models just a couple nights ago and have that conversation with them for the first time. And these aren't, you know, there is a sort of models' rights organization, and these are not people who are engaged in that discussion yet. These are people who are like, rights are an interesting thing. Like, let's talk about them as a possibility. And to sit in a room with people that had just barely started to realize that maybe it wasn't okay that they weren't getting their paychecks on time, or they were being forced to work overtime, or that, you know, there was like surprise nudity in a shoot that they hadn't agreed to in advance, which actually happens a lot more than I thought it did. And so they asked me to talk to them about, like, my experiences interviewing people across the entirety of the supply chain, from warehouse workers in Walmart, like, clothing departments, to people who worked in thrift stores, to people who worked in fast fashion retail outlets, to people who, like, just did, like, general shipping supply stuff. And the more stories that I told from the consistent surveillance and rapes in warehousing and in thrift store environments, constant overtime, constant wage theft, etc., the more the models in the room, like, beautiful, beautiful people, were basically just, like, their eyes were widening and their mouths were dropping, and they were saying things like, that happened to me last week, and just fitting together that this entire industry is sort of a piece. It tends to treat people similarly at every single stage. So that essay sort of follows that same logic.
So I know I said that was in conclusion, but Yeah, the title is body horror, and there is certainly a touch of exaggeration involved in that, but not entirely.
Yeah.
A friend of mine once characterized a friend of her, an English person who characterized a friend of hers, who's also English, as like seeing his body either as something he doesn't think about or a source of terror to him. And nothing, never is a source of pleasure. Has this experience of chronic illness really changed your relationship to your body and its terrors and pleasures?
Yes, for sure. One thing that's really interesting, when I started doing more like research on like pain and how people have written about pain in the past, in terms of literature, but also in terms of like actual research into various kinds of pain, and then of course you very quickly get into like S&M theory and some of the people that have done really interesting work around how BDSM actually is you know, not terribly like medically condoned treatment for pain management. And really thinking about the range of ways that we experience bodies is pretty spectacular. But the very truth of it is that being in a body that is more likely than not to have some kind of pain going on is like a really centering thing. And it just makes you more aware of what bodies do and what they're capable of and what it takes for a body to like get through a day, which being aware of that is not a blessing. It's not, it's like being aware of the process just makes you more exhausted by the process.
Well, as the disability rights activists say, we're all just temporarily able.
Yeah.
And those of us who are temporarily able don't think about that very much, but I guess it's very much front and center in your life.
Yeah, and those of us who do, you know, you even like in those moments where you're temporarily able, you get really excited about it and you yes, okay, appreciate it more, but you're also like surveilling it in such a close way that it's not just experiencing it. It's just like, it's like making sure at every moment that every aspect of your body is like as awesome as it can be. It's pretty exhausting for sure.
That was Anne Elizabeth Moore talking about her new book, Body Horror, from Curbside Splendor. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Haydn's Piano Trio No. 31, first movement, performed by the Beaux-Arts Trio. Next, Greg Kaplan. He is one of four authors, along with Fatih Gunvin, Jay Song, and Justin Wiedner, of a new study of lifetime earnings for U.S. workers over the last five decades. Most of what you read about income distribution is a cross-section, a snapshot of a single year. But what about incomes over a lifetime? That's also an important perspective, but one that's hard to study because the data isn't easily available. But with this paper, Kaplan, an economist at the University of Chicago, and his colleagues used Social Security data to take a long and careful look about what's been happening with worker incomes over time. Hint, it's not a happy story. Greg Kaplan.
Most income studies that we read, in the academic literature and the popular literature as well, are about income at any given point in time, cross-sectional pictures. You're looking at lifetime incomes. Could you tell us a bit about the difference and the availability of data on lifetime incomes has been a challenge, right?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely right. It's been much harder to get data on lifetime incomes than on annual incomes. And the reason is just that to get data on someone's income over their lifetime, you need to follow them for a long period of time. And most of the data sources that people use to study income inequality and income distributions, they're not able to follow people for sufficiently long periods of time to get a proper understanding of what their total income picture looks like.
In the U.S., there's been a panel survey of income dynamics that people have used, but I guess a lot of people drop out of that, don't they?
That's one problem, yeah, that with any panel study, you have a problem of attrition. Some people drop out. The panel study of income dynamics has been going on since the late 1960s. Since 1997, they unfortunately only ask income data, income questions every 2 years. It's become a biannual study. But the biggest problem with looking at survey data like the panel study of income dynamics is simply the size. It's just not big enough to be able to get a full and accurate description of income distributions over such a long period of time.
I was interested to learn that economists and others have been looking at this question for quite a long time. I believe you cite somebody as early as 1853 who was trying to answer these questions of lifetime incomes. What were they after in doing that?
Yeah, that's right. So from a theoretical perspective, it's been well known to economists that if you want to capture inequality in welfare, inequality in standards of living, then it's better to look at income over long periods of time. Over a lifetime would be pushing that to its limits, than it is to look at incomes in a point of time. And this idea is simply that people experience fluctuations in their incomes from year to year. So looking at somebody's income in a particular year, it may or may not give you an accurate reflection of what their quality of life, what their standard, material standard of living is over a longer horizon. It may be that you happen to sample them in a year where their income was particularly low, or perhaps in a year when they're particularly high. It also may be that they're in a career or some type of job in which they start out, income starts out low, say, for example, in the medical profession where doctors have periods of a long period of education before they go on to make larger salaries. So you'll look at them and those early years and get a sense that their income is low, but really over the course of their lifetime, they might have very high incomes. So this idea that if you want to measure inequality in well-being and you want to do it through income distributions, you're going to be much better off looking at income over the lifetime. At a theoretical level, that's been known for a really long time. As you alluded to, the difficulty has been getting the data to be able to do that.
And you use Social Security data, which in some sense seems obvious. Why has this not been done more often before?
Well, that's a good question. And the Social Security data has been used before to study income distributions. I think this is the first study that's used it to look at income over the full period from ages 25 to 55. I guess these things just take time.
Okay. So your findings, let's get to those. First, it's very important to look at these by gender, right? If you just look at the aggregate numbers, you're not going to get a very accurate picture of what's going on. So let's start with men. What do you find for men?
So for men, we see some findings that are a little bit concerning. We find that if you look at the distribution of lifetime incomes, for men from, say, the cohorts who are entering the labor markets, turning around age 25, entering the labor markets in the late 1950s and 1960s, all the way to those entering the labor market in the 1980s, we've seen very little rise in overall lifetime incomes at the middle of the distribution. Median lifetime incomes, so that's the lifetime income of the person in the middle of the distribution, from the cohort entering in the 1967 to that entering in 1981, so these are the most, 1981 being the most recent cohort of people for which we're able to observe their incomes all the way up to age 55, we've seen basically a decline in lifetime incomes. And in fact, going all the way up to the 75th percentile of the lifetime income distributions, that means for roughly three quarters of men, we're seeing basically no increase in lifetime incomes across those periods. So it's really a picture of stagnation of lifetime incomes for men.
And then women, a rather different story.
Yeah, exactly. Women, very different. As we know, this is a period of time over which we've seen a massive increase of women into the labor market, along with a closing of the gender pay gap. We're seeing that closing of the gender pay gap in a lifetime perspective as well as in the annual income perspective that we're more familiar with. In other words, if you look at more recent cohorts of women and look at the total lifetime incomes that they're earning, those more recent cohorts are earning income that's closer to that of men than it was for previous cohorts. So we've seen a big catch up. I should say, though, that because women were starting out and the cohorts starting out in the 1950s and 1960s at such a low level of lifetime income relative to men, even though there's been a massive increase for women, there's still a big gap across genders in lifetime income today.
Now, those increases in women's lifetime income, is it a result of more women working at all, more women working longer hours, were earning higher rates of pay? How do you break that down?
Well, Doug, it's both, actually. So we can break that down by looking at the changes in income for women, even conditioning on having been in the labor market. So we can adjust for those changes in the labor market participation that we've seen over that period. And we find that the increase for women is comprised of both of those two forces. So both an increase in work and an increase in pay while working.
And then put this together for the entire population. What's that picture look like?
Well, when you take the population as a whole, it still kind of looks a little bit picture of stagnation. Because women were starting out at such low levels of income, the big gains that they've seen are not enough to offset the declines and stagnating income for men. So if you look at the bulk of the distribution, we're seeing one of pretty much not much increase over this period.
Now, the standard picture of income over the course of a lifetime is, you know, it's pretty low when you're young, rises rapidly from, say, your mid-20s into your mid-40s or early 50s, and then it sort of flattens and begins declining. Do you find that stylized picture to be more or less accurate?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way of thinking about what income looks like over the lifetime. Starts out low, increases through the 20s, 30s, and early 40s, and then from the 40s and 50s into the last part of the working life, it tends to flatten out. What we're finding is if we compare those profiles for some of the older cohorts with those cohorts of workers in the labor market today, we're seeing that general pattern is still the same with one important key change. And that change is that if you look at incomes at the time of entry into the labor market, so at the ages of 25 and mid and late 20s, those incomes for cohorts today are much lower than they were for those of the previous generation. But because the life cycle profiles look very similar, this means that lower income when they're young is not being made up for by higher income later on in life. And that's why we're seeing lower lifetime incomes for the cohorts, the younger cohorts, more recent cohorts, and those that are in the labor market today. They're starting out lower, they're growing at the same rate, so overall their lifetime incomes are going to end up not as high as those in the generation before.
I'm sitting with Greg Kaplan, who's an economics professor at the University of Chicago. And when did that trend first start showing up?
So for men, we start seeing this change for the cohorts entering in the late 60s and early 70s. For women, because there was that big period of catch up with men, it's more recent than that for cohorts entering in the 90s.
You know, we hear a lot about how rough people in their 20s have it now, but it's been getting rougher for people in their 20s for several decades, right?
That's right. That's what we're finding. It's a tough time in the labor market for young people.
And your measure of income looks basically just direct pay, the kinds of things that's in a paycheck that gets reported to the Social Security. But what about fringe benefits? You have no direct access to that, but what do your proxies tell you?
Yeah, well, that's right. So I should say that the data that we look at comes from W-2 data. So W-2 is the form that the employers send to the IRS to report income earned in terms of salaries, bonuses, commissions, those sorts of things. Of course, there's all sorts of other types of income that we're not including in our study because we don't have access to it. It's going to be things like capital income, so interest and dividends and profits and things that are typically earned by people at the top of the income distribution. But one type of income that is earned by a lot of people through the bulk of the distribution that's also not captured in the W-2 salary income is fringe benefits. And those have changed a lot over this period. So we've seen a big increase in employer-provided health insurance and employer contributions to tax-deferred retirement accounts, 401ks, and so forth. What we can't observe them directly, but what we can do is we can look at the total increase in employer provided benefits in the economy as a whole, and every year, and we can try and allocate these to cohorts by looking at the total income earned by different cohorts. Now, what we can do is try get a rough upper bound on how much we're losing by not accounting for this rise in employer-provided fringe benefits. And our back-of-the-envelope calculations suggest that that if you were to include the value of those health insurance and those retirement accounts, some of the stagnation that we've been talking about would be mitigated, but the general picture wouldn't be overturned. In other words, those changes are there, but they're not big enough to overturn the sorts of trends and patterns that we've been talking about.
Over the periods that you're talking about, we've seen real GDP, real aggregate incomes, increase by 3, 4, or 5 times. Yet, even in the case of women's income, we're seeing relatively modest increases, and with men's, we're seeing declines. How do you reconcile what individuals are experiencing, what the macro economy is telling us?
That's absolutely right. That's a great point. You know, GDP has increased a tremendous amount over the period that we're studying. So where is that income going? I mean, that's another way of phrasing the question you're asking. How can we reconcile the fact that there's a whole bunch of extra income in the economy being earned every year, but yet we're seeing lifetime incomes for recent cohorts not increasing very much relative to previous cohorts? The answer is, broadly speaking, 3 places. So let me talk about each of them in turn. So the first is that women. So a much bigger fraction of annual income every year is going to women today than it was in the past. So that's part of it. But the second place is, even for men, a lot of that additional income is going to the very top of the distribution. So even though we're seeing stagnation of lifetime incomes, as I described, in the middle of the distribution, even up to like the bottom 3/4 of the distribution, at the very top, in the top 5-10% of the distribution, we have seen an increase in lifetime incomes. So a lot of that increase has been going to the top of the distribution. So those are 2 places that I think many of your listeners will be familiar with. The one that I guess people aren't quite familiar with is the third reason, and that's that it's going to older workers. So if you look at the age distribution, both of the workforce and even conditional on working, where the pie of labor income is going in a given year, it's shifted a lot from young workers to older workers. And that's even taking into account that there's more older workers around. What that means is that if you think about in a given year, say today, where is the income going to in terms of cohorts of people? Which cohorts are getting it? So, well, because it's going to older workers, those are also older cohorts. So it's going back to the lifetime income of the earlier cohorts. So this shift of the income distribution towards older workers also helps to reconcile why we see overall income in a given year increasing, yet the lifetime incomes of the newer cohorts not increasing as fast a rate.
And those older cohorts will be retiring or eventually dropping dead. What can we expect for the future as these younger cohorts age into middle and later age? I know this is obviously speculative to some degree, but knowing what you know about the course of lifetime incomes, are they going to be as well-favored as the earlier ones were?
Well, obviously, it's hard to know. One thing we do know is that these older cohorts, even the ones in the labor force today, are going to be working much longer than the older cohorts a generation ago. So in that sense, it's hard to know how that's going to play out. One thing we can look at is we can look at income that younger cohorts have earned over the first, say, 5 or 10 years, 15 years in the labor market. So we can look at the millennial generation and see how much did they earn on average in the first 10 years in the labor market. That's some information we already know. And we can compare that with the income earned by the first 10 years in the labor market of previous generations. And when we do that, we see, again, a pretty depressing picture, particularly for men, but even for women, this seems to be becoming closer and closer to that of men, which is that over the first decade or so in the labor market, these younger generations, on average, seem to be earning less rather than the generations that came before then. So of course it's hard to know what the labour market, the future of the labour market looks like, and for all we know there might be some fantastic growth across the board going forward. But just based on what we've seen so far, it doesn't look like that trend is reversing.
And can you tell whether that's the result of transient effects like the Great Recession, the financial crisis, or is this some longer-term secular development?
Well, look, it is really hard to know. As you allude to, the data that we have for the 2000s, from 2008 onwards, is confounded with the fact that there has been a big recession over that period. So the short answer is we don't know. One thing we do know is that the decline of incomes for young workers started a long time before the most recent recession. There was a brief resurgence in the late 1990s and early 2000s, but that resurgence wasn't enough even to overcome the declines that had been seen in the 10 or 20 years before that. So this, at least part of it, does seem to be a longer term trend. How much of the decline we've seen in recent years is a temporary blip from that trend, and how much of it is a steepening of that trend? Well, we'll have to wait and see.
And finally, you all doing any additional work with this data that you haven't written up yet?
We have a lot of work ongoing. In particular, one of the things that we're looking at is to take a deeper look at the more recent cohorts in the labour market today, and try and get a better sense of what income dynamics look like over the life cycle and how that's changed, particularly for people at the top of the income distribution and for people at the bottom of the income distribution, which we don't know as much about. And then we're trying to dig a little bit deeper into the life cycle profiles and lifetime income patterns for women, which is something that we as economists don't know as much about because we don't have as many cohorts to look at.
That was Greg Kaplan at the University of Chicago. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, some more from the Haydn Piano Trio No. 31, this from the second movement, also performed by the Beaux-Arts Trio. Till next week, bye.